May it please the court, Chief Justice Tileman, your honors, on behalf of the Metropolitan St. Louis Sewer District, or MSD, I'm here to ask you to reverse the trial court's judgment with regard to the Hancock Amendment issue in phase one of this trial, because the trial court misdeclared the law, misapplied the law, or made factual findings with no basis in the record or against the overwhelming weight of the evidence. He made no credibility findings. There were really no disputes of fact. It was an issue of what conclusions to draw. And if you rule in our favor on the Hancock Amendment issue and agree with us that this is a user charge, not a tax, you need not reach the refund and attorney's fees issues. And before going to the five Keller factors in order, I'd like to make a few preliminary points. Number one, impervious area is the industry standard in this country for rate purposes for stormwater entities, just as water was the industry standard for wastewater services in the Missouri growth case. It is the industry standard because it is a fair way, it's easily understandable, it's equitable, it's objective. People can have them come out and measure it if they disagree. And it also is what causes the need for the system. Forests do not need a stormwater system. Urban areas do because of the building of impervious area here. Secondly, there's a direct relationship between impervious area and the amount of additional runoff or incremental runoff, whatever you want to call it, that is caused by the impervious area. And there's no dispute about that. The plaintiff's experts agreed.
Now, there's no way to measure the stormwater discharge, is there?
No practical way to do it. Our meter is the impervious area because of the direct relationship between that and the additional runoff caused by that impervious area, which doesn't vary depending on slope, soil content, size of lot, or anything else.
But just because there's no way to measure it, and you're doing it by the amount of impervious area, and that's what you say is the standard in your particular industry, does that make it the right way to be able to apply these Keller factors? Is that, how do we correlate that with other Hancock issues?
Well, we think it is the right way, and I'm going to try and discuss all five of the Keller issues and explain why we think it complies with certainly with four of the five. The fifth one we think perhaps should be inconclusive, as it was in the Missouri growth case. But the first four factors should all be decided in favor of MSD. I would like to make one other point before moving to those Keller factors, and that is the Missouri growth case, while it's a decision of the Court of Appeals Eastern District, it was decided there only after briefing and oral argument in this court, and then it was sent back to the Court of Appeals to reinstate the opinion there. If I can move on to factor one, is the bill on or after service? The trial court was incorrect on this factor. He misdeclared and misapplied the law because he only looked at the fact that this was a monthly payment. It was periodic. He didn't look at whether it was on or after the services were rendered. And on that issue, this is the evidence. It was undisputed. The December 2007 ordinance in question here, which was Exhibit B, Ordinance 126560, said that it would become effective on March 1 of 2008, but no bills were to be sent out until April 1 of 2008 for March. Secondly, we put on the chief financial officer, Jan Zimmerman, and she testified that the billing for stormwater services was never in advance, always in arrears. We put on Jeff Thierman, the executive director of MSD, and he testified that if impervious area was added to or subtracted from a particular parcel of property, that it would go on the rolls, the additional or lesser amount would go on the rolls after, only after the impervious area was added or subtracted, and sometimes there was a lag. So obviously, those services based on that impervious area were after the fact, not before. Two other points on this point. I'll move on to factor two. The Missouri growth case relied exclusively on the language of MSD's ordinance to find this factor in favor of MSD. We didn't just rely on that. Obviously, if it was totally arbitrary to say that, it wouldn't work. But that was the sole basis for the decision in the Missouri growth case versus MSD. But we went beyond that, and we put on the evidence that I've just outlined. Finally, the trial, well, two other things. This was an ongoing service, like the Tri-County Levy District case from the Court of Appeals Eastern District. And they found factor one in favor of the levy district because it was an ongoing service. Also, the trial judge relied on the building owner's case from the Western District to say that you had to be able to accept, reject, or limit the services. That is not a factor under the Arbor case, under the Keller case, under the Missouri growth case, under the Mullenix case. It's just an outlier, and the Western District, the trial judge should not have relied on that.
Now, the Court of Appeals said that you failed in that point because you didn't show evidence that the ratepayer actually used that service during the previous billing cycle. What type of burden of proof, or how can you accomplish that?
Well, there is no...
let's say it was August and there was
right.
a drought, like it was last summer. How do you prove that you had a new...
Well, as I said, this is an ongoing service. It has to be available whether or not it rains 10 inches or the sun is out. And the services are caused by the development of the impervious area. And Ameren UE can't tell you whether they cut down trees in your area or they don't vary the bill depending on how far you are from their generating plant. Nobody can say exactly what services are being performed. And the system here, the stormwater system, was based on 15 and 20 year design storms, so that the rate, the payments, had nothing to do with the actual amount of rainfall. This was just an objective and an appropriate and fair and equitable way of determining the costs and applying those costs on a proportionate basis based on the impervious area, because that's what causes the need for the system.
But that doesn't make it not a tax. A really good, fair tax is still a tax, right?
Yes, but this is a user charge in our view because it does comport with all five Keller factor issues and the decision of this court in the Arbor case and the other cases. If I can move on to factor two, who pays the bill? Is it blanket billed? It was not in this case. There were 38,000 people with undeveloped land who were not billed, just as the 75,000 people in the wastewater case, the Missouri Growth versus MSD. The other factor here is that those 600 customers out of 480,000 who drained internally or into one of the three rivers ended up getting a 50% credit because, and those were for the costs of the infrastructure and the operation and maintenance of that infrastructure by MSD. They did pay for appropriately the other services, the regulatory and planning services of MSD, because their impervious area still caused pollutants to go into the creeks and into the rivers, and MSD had a duty to monitor those pollutants, not remediate them, but monitor them. So that, in our view, was appropriate. And the judge's reasoning here was so flawed. He said it seems that MSD did this to comply with the law. Well, first of all, this was a rational, principled decision to treat all the property owners the same way. And if the undeveloped land was not billed to people with no impervious area, and it was not billed to people with impervious area. But let's assume for a minute that we did it to comply with the law. I'm not sure there's anything wrong with that. Moreover, if we had billed these 38,000 people, the plaintiffs with some justification would be saying, well, you did blanket bill this, and they would put us in an absolute no-win position. This was a principled decision consistent with the entire rationale that impervious area had a direct relationship to the additional runoff caused by that impervious area. Also, not-for-profits, governmental entities, educational institutions, churches, did not pay any of the ad valorem taxes, but they did pay this user charge. So they were finally being billed for a fair amount for their use and demand on the stormwater system of MSD. Moving on to factor three is the amount of the fee affected by the level of goods and services. This was a variable and individual rate, not a flat fee, not a uniform fee. And the plaintiffs set up a straw man that there was no relationship between impervious area and total runoff. We agree. They didn't have to spend $400,000 on experts to prove that. If you have a
if you didn't get this fee, how would you pay for the drainage and the sewage? How would you pay for it if you didn't get this fee?
Well, MSD has gone back for the time being. They suspended the user charge on August 1 of 2010, before there was an injunction and immediately after the judge's decision on phase one, and reinstituted their ad valorem taxes and the 24 cent per month fee, which raises about $20 to $21 million.
Is that charged to everybody, including the 38,000? Who don't have impervious areas?
Well, yeah, if they're the property owner would pay the ad valorem tax based on the assessed valuation of his unimproved property. Yes, that's true.
That's, you seem to have touched on a key difference between the two parties, which is, do you look at total runoff versus do you look at runoff from the impervious area? Do you look at the increased runoff as a result of the impervious area and compare in deciding what use is being made, or do you look at all runoff? Can you address that more fundamentally?
Yes, I will. Let me start in addressing that by reading from Exhibit B, which is the ordinance in question here, 12560. And on the third page, the second whereas clause reads as follows, quote, whereas owners or users of improved property within the district, whether public or private, are served by and benefit from the stormwater system in that the man-made impervious surface on such improved property contributes to stormwater runoff, which occurs from such property, and here is the critical language, beyond the amount which would occur if such property were undeveloped and in its natural state. Now that is talking about the additional runoff caused by the impervious area. So this isn't something that was made up for this litigation. That's always the way MSD looked at it. That's the way the expert looked at it. That's the way their staff looked at it. And you can also look on the same exhibit, Exhibit B, page 5, to the definition of served in service, which is consistent with that. It was always additional runoff that was being viewed by MSD, never total runoff. There is no relationship between impervious area and total runoff, but there is a direct linear relationship, and the plaintiffs, the Court of Appeals, the trial judge, never addressed this issue. They just said runoff, total runoff.
In a related vein, can you address their argument that we have to look at the benefit to the individual property owner as opposed to the cost to you or to the system?
Well, yes. Let's analogize that for a moment to the 75,000 septic tank users in the Missouri Growth versus MSDK. They were not paying anything, yet they benefit in the fact that there is a stormwater a wastewater system in place. And the Larson versus City of Sullivan case said that the existence of the sewage treatment plant in that case was a service to the city. There were people unconnected. They were being charged. That was wrong. But they were benefiting from the system because at some point either they or a subsequent owner might hook up into it. So you don't have to show an individual benefit. That's just the wrong way to look at it. The way to look at it, in our view, is to look at the charge or demand that the additional runoff causes to the system. That is what was being used for rate purposes here. We weren't sizing a system in the first instance. We were figuring out a fair and objective way to develop a rate here. And let me just refer you to the transcript. The plaintiff's experts agreed with us. There was no direct, that there is a direct linear relationship between impervious area and additional or incremental runoff. And look at the transcript, page 615, line 23, to page 621, line 15. That's Mr. Jones' testimony. And Mr. Debo, their other expert, in his book, part of which is Exhibit WW, said, the more you pave, the more you pay. And you can also look at his testimony at page 357, line 14, to page 362, line 4, where he also, although slippery a bit, agrees that there is a direct relationship between impervious area and additional runoff from the impervious area.
Is it a pun, slippery?
Well, I didn't mean it as one, Judge Teitelman. Factor four, services. Let me point out that in the Arbor case, the Missouri Growth case, and in the Mullenix case, the plaintiffs agreed that there were services being rendered. The defendant didn't have to put on any evidence. There was no such stipulation here.
You will have some time for rebuttal.
Okay.
But you've gone over your time, and I appreciate it, but you'll have three more minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
And you'll have some extra time, too, if you like, depending on our questions.
Thank you.
You have a lot of questions, I'm sure.
All right. Thank you. May it please the Court, Richard Hardcastle on behalf of respondents, the ratepayers. Since Keller, no political subdivision has withstood a Hancock challenge without a finding in its favor on Keller Factor 3, which requires there to be a direct relationship between the charge and the service or goods provided to the user. I think that that might be important because Keller Factor 3 comes the closest to identifying whether a fee is levied, imposed on a taxpayer who doesn't have a choice or option, in which case it's a tax, or whether the fee is charged to
That's not a Keller factor. Is it if it's a choice or option, it's a tax? That's not one of the factors set out in Keller or in Arbor.
Well, I think one of the factors that to be considered is whether the fee is levied, because Hancock does prohibit the levy of a fee. The exception that has been carved out of that is for fees that the court has determined are charges. They're not imposed without choice or option. They're like the ambulance service. So, for example, here, there's no question but this is a levy, a fee charged. If you own an impervious area, you get charged. If you take steps to minimize the runoff from your property, you pay full boat. You cannot turn off the service. You can't turn it on. You can't elect to buy more of it, presuming that you knew what it was. You pay the same month in, month out, whether it rains or it shines. And if you don't pay your bill, MSD can't turn off the switch to the services to you, because it has no control over that. But what they can do is impose a lien on your property, which under Arbor is a badge of a tax. And if you think about it here for a second, not every charge or not every cost that a governmental entity incurs can be chopped up and passed along as a fee under an exception to Hancock. And I think that what we have here is that's the very circumstance.
On what basis are you saying that it could be a user fee?
I don't think, Judge Stith, in this case, this stormwater user charge, I don't think it's susceptible to being a user fee. And if you look at what they do, I think you might understand and perhaps agree with me as to why that is. MSD provides two things in their user fee. 50% of it goes to regulatory services, their EPA compliance, their public education, their clean water endeavors, that sort of thing. Well, everyone benefits equally from those sorts of activities by MSD. You certainly don't benefit more or less than your neighbor.
But you keep going to benefit, and benefit's not the issue. Is it a user fee or is it a tax? Not how much benefit you get, but do they charge you by use?
Well, you don't use any more of the EPA compliance that MSD is an activity based on the length of your driveway. You certainly don't get any more benefit than your neighbor based on your impervious area. You don't really use that service at all. It's a benefit to everyone, and that's the problem. MSD's executive director.
Why is using the impervious? I understand there's many ways you could measure this. Are you suggesting there's only one? Why is not using the impervious area a reasonable way to estimate the use of the stormwater system by homeowners?
Well, that's a different question, and our evidence was there is no direct relationship between impervious area and the runoff from your property.
Well, they're saying that doesn't have to be. They're charging for the extra runoff.
Well, they're not. They're simply not. I mean, there's no measurement of additional runoff. There's no such thing as this additional runoff concept, as we proved at trial, and MSD wants to relitigate the facts here. And if you think about it for a second, if you put 100 square feet of paved area in the middle of a cornfield or on a 3-acre lot, the runoff, the additional runoff from that may or may not be existent at all, as our experts prove. If you take that same amount and put it adjacent to your driveway, which leads right to an inlet into MSD's sewer, there might be more runoff. But they don't charge based on additional runoff.
So you're saying that the amount charged has got to directly relate to the service provided?
Pardon me?
The amount charged has got to directly relate to the service provided. Is
yes,
that what you're saying?
I am saying
that.
But
measure
how
can the
water.
They do that? What kind of fee, how would they assess it?
But I don't believe that they can in this case. I simply don't think this is amenable.
So
to
why isn't this the most... Since measuring the water that actually goes into each drain is not possible, why can they not get as close as reasonably practicable, which is measuring it by how much you can no longer absorb in the ground because you've paved it?
Well, because scientifically there is no correlation, as we proved.
But isn't that an issue you should take up in the rate case? We're not sitting here trying to figure out if they've charged exactly right or they're figuring out the runoff. We're trying to decide, is it a user fee or a tax?
Well, what are you using? That's the question. And you have to fit in the Keller, which requires there to be a direct relationship between the charge and the goods or services delivered to the ratepayer. MSD will tell you, they testified, we can't tell you what service we delivered.
So they did a direct relationship between the charge and the impervious property, and you're saying that there's no relationship to the creation of the wastewater system?
Correct. There's absolutely no relationship. Take a new development. If you take a new piece of property in St. Louis County and develop it into a shopping center, to get a permit from MSD, you have to assure that it is designed so that after developed, there's no more runoff from that property than prior to its development.
And
so there is no additional
runoff.
Can you
address their argument? I believe they say that addresses the quality of the water, not the quantity.
Well, their permit addresses the quantity. And there is no evidence, and that's a fact that's found in two locations in the first judgment. There is no fact-finding, and I read that in the brief. It was the first time I'd ever heard that the permitting is directed to water quality. It is directed to runoff, as the engineer, Mr. Holscher, testified both at trial and in his deposition. So that's settled. They want to relitigate it now, but it is settled and it has not been properly appealed. And the other part of what they do, aside from the regulatory, is they maintain an infrastructure. The main purpose of the infrastructure is to keep water off the roads so that they're passable. Now, my benefit is no different than your benefit if you happen to be driving through St. Louis County and don't even own property in the area if the water is clear. I certainly don't gain any more benefit by the length of my driveway.
Again, the question is use. It's a user fee, not a benefit fee.
Well, I'm not using the stormwater system any more than you are if you're evacuating water from the roads. Ironically, owners of roads, probably the biggest causer of runoff, both private and public owners, pay nothing. They're exempt. I'd like to talk a little bit, if I could, about the refund in this case. Judge Dildine said he would have awarded a refund in this case, except for MSD had spent the money, and he saw the only recourse of funding a refund would go back to the plaintiff's class to, in essence, pay themselves a refund. The judge noted that he thought that seemed wrong. We agree with him. It was wrong. This is the nature of class action litigation, be it a ratepayer or commercial. In some sense, you're always going to be paying yourselves back. That was the case in Ring, where the court set up a $30 million refund for the MSD wastewater payers from future credits against bills, which is something that we could do in this case if we go back to the trial court. The judge looked at two reasons for denying the refund. The first is 139.031, and that is a statute that requires a tax to be paid under protest under certain circumstances. We submit if 139.031 is deemed to apply in this case, you will never have a refund, and certainly not a class action refund, in a Hancock case. It's dead. No ratepayer over a $3 charge is going to file a written protest monthly with MSD, spelling out a bill of particulars as to what his complaint is, followed up by a lawsuit to protect his rights to recover the refund, which will cost, for the $3 refund, in excess of $100, followed by monthly amendments to the pleading. It just won't happen, and it doesn't need to happen.
Counsel, did you seek any preliminary relief in the way of a TRO or injunction?
We did not seek a TRO. We did not seek a preliminary injunction for the reason that the rules require a bond to be posted. And we're talking about a $90 million issue here. And at the time, we had plaintiff Dr. Zweig, later expanded into a class. But Dr. Zweig, over his $5 fee, was not about to pony up a $90 million bond. That's why we didn't
do
that.
Just as a matter of policy, why do you suppose they require bonds for injunction?
As a matter of policy, because if you're wrong, then there is a fund for the aggrieved party to go back after.
And why wouldn't that policy apply here?
Why wouldn't it?
Why wouldn't that policy apply here? I know it's a burden, but why isn't it an unfair or insurmountable burden, as it is in any other case?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your
Honor. I understand that posting a bond would be difficult in this case. It's difficult in any case. Why does that make it insurmountable here? Why does that necessarily mean that you shouldn't have had to go through that process, if not the statutory process for seeking a refund?
Well, I mean, there's no requirement that we seek a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction to prevent them from doing what they did, MSD is fully aware and was fully aware at the time they enacted the stormwater user fee that a Hancock Amendment challenge was likely. They had a contingency plan, which they've since implemented, to continue to fund their ongoing stormwater services. So MSD says, gee, you should have stopped me. Well, gee, maybe MSD should have taken the money and escrowed it themselves. Maybe MSD should have reinstated the ad valorem tax that they've since done and wait till this played out. Instead, what MSD did was they collected and spent as much of this money as they possibly could, even at some after the injunction was entered, and they come back, they come to this court and want to be rewarded for their gamble. They want to be told that their defense of I spent the money is a solid defense.
Now, let me ask you about the back to pass relief. This is not the same thing as the ticket price on the family arena review for that one. But the it's they know who they charge the fee to. They could just discount the next bill. I mean, it's not hard to find who they charge the fee to. To give them the money back if that's a class relief.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. I mean, they certainly have records of who was charged and when. There may be some complications if some people have moved out of the district. That was clear in the wastewater case. But these are details that a trial court with some discretion
can figure out. Can you address
the
timeliness issue? Opposing counsel says the named plaintiffs even didn't file timely, and you say you don't have to under City of Hazelwood, but in that case, as in Judge Wolf's concurring opinion in Green, the court said the City of Hazelwood timely filed suit for the disputed amount it is entitled to recover. It distinguished between timely filing suit and then what you needed to do under Hancock.
Judge Stith, we do have to timely file.
Tell me about how it's timely.
We're not contending otherwise, and we contend that filing the lawsuit within 90 days of receiving the bill is timely. I mean, most people don't even didn't recognize, our Dr. Zhuai plaintiff didn't recognize that he had a $3 bill on his bill for some 60 days when he sought counsel. That's about as quick as you can get. Any of these other cases that have applied 139 in the Eastern District have all been situations where the plaintiff slept on their rights for years and are coming back to a school district or something like that and saying, pay me the money, where the school district says, well, I'm sorry, but I spent the money. Well, MSD is making the same claim here. I spent the money, but they did it with full knowledge that this litigation was ongoing. And think of the precedent that you will set. If you accept as a defense, I spent the money, what is going to stop any municipality, any political subdivision from implementing a fee that they think is questionable?
Well, what is the requirement on timely filing in the statute?
Well, there isn't one. It just says, and I would agree, that a suit must be filed timely. But certainly, maybe they have an argument for the first 90 days that we didn't sue them, but
when
they don't
you,
have one afterwards.
When did you amend it to make it a class action?
It was always pled to be certified as a class action.
Okay.
The class certification took a while because we had two judges recuse themselves in St. Louis.
But
County.
The initial petition.
The initial
was a class,
yes. Okay. Oh, of course, we pled it okay. as a class action.
Okay.
So we submit that unless a refund in a case of this kind is given, there won't be Hancock litigation for little guys who have $3 and $5 bills. So for that reason, we would urge that the court sustain the lower court's finding of a violation of the Hancock Amendment.
And the attorney's fees issue, where would that?
Well, here's where we are on the attorney's fees, Judge. If you were to find that a refund is not proper, but the Hancock Amendment was violated and reach attorney's fees, then you reach the issue of Volkswagen and the Lodestar, which was doubled in our case and also recently approved in Volkswagen. And here you'll also find in paragraphs 3 through 27, I believe, of the third judgment, detailed findings by our trial judge of the seven factors identified in our rules of professional conduct for approving a Lodestar. You will also find, and Judge Stith, notably, you were you were concerned in Volkswagen about the proportionality between the amount of the fees and
well,
and
about duplicating factors and using them both for the Lodestar and for the multiplier.
All right. Well, first, on the proportionality, mm-hmm. We had an achievement of a savings to 480,000 ratepayers of $300 million through 2014. Secondly, just like in Volkswagen, we have the same factors here. Ours was a contingent fee. They're paid by the hour. Ours required giving up other perhaps less risky work to work on this case. When you're preparing for trial.
Those are all the factors listed in the rules for a Lodestar fee.
Well, those were the three additional ones found by the majority in Volkswagen to be important. There are other factors that the judge found which would entitle us to an enhancement. The first one being the success that we achieved in saving the class $300 million. The second was we were the only firm and only firm willing to take on a case that would require this sort of investment, nearly $500,000 out of pocket, much less millions of dollars in attorney's fees. And third, the court noted that this was a case which was vigorously defended by MSD, veterans of Hancock litigation. Anything else?
And that would be decided by the trial court, not by our court as far as your
That's what you did in Volkswagen, Your right. Honor, and I think that would make sense. Just affirm that the sure. Lodestar and the multiplier is appropriate. In remand, we have asked for our attorney's fees on the course of
appeals. Any more questions?
Appeals.
We did go over with that. Any more points you want to make at this point? Thank you.
Thank you.
May I take a few more minutes, Your Honor?
Well, you got
Please.
3 minutes.
Thank you.
I gave you a lot too much time before.
Let me address the last issue that he made. The McCarthy Leonard Law Firm, which is a good law firm in St. Louis County, sought to intervene in this case. They were ready, willing, and able to represent the class, so that should be put aside for a moment. Let me address the refund issue first.
Did they intervene?
We joined them in opposing them, and the judge denied intervention.
Okay. But they could have opted out of the class, too.
Your yeah. point is others would have taken the case.
Pardon?
You're saying other counsel
yes.
would have taken the case.
Yes. Sure. With regard to the refund, first of all, you can affirm, if you reach that issue, which we don't think you need to, you can affirm on the equitable discretion of the trial judge in denying it. But let's assume for a minute that when they filed suit, we had suspended the user charge, and we had reinstated the ad valorem taxes and the 24-cent fee. First of all,
why did you change?
Pardon?
Why did you change from the ad valorem tax, which seemed to be paying for the drainage and all the rest,
no,
and go to
no,
this new system?
Your Honor, it wasn't. It was paying about $20 to $21 million out of a $40 million budget for stormwater services. The other $19 million was a subsidy from the wastewater funds. But let's assume for a minute that we had suspended the user charge and gone back to that ad valorem system and collected the $21 million. There was no more wastewater subsidy because the rate commission had told us to eliminate that, which we had. We collect that money. We're going to have to spend that. The stormwater system still has to operate. And we would have spent all that money, too. There wouldn't have been any money there for a refund if we had suspended the user charge. We still had to run a stormwater system, and it's total speculation what the bond would have been. Mr. Zweig, when he was the sole plaintiff, could have sought a preliminary injunction. I don't know what the court would have said about a bond at that point, but they never sought it. Let me just make a few other points. The fee does not have to be perfect. The wastewater fee in the Missouri Growth versus MSD was based on one reading of the water meter between November and April, and bills for the next 12 months were sent out on that, and it didn't even purport to measure what came out of the house, the effluent. It just measured what went in. That was good enough. And in all the other cases, the Arbor case, the Mullenix case, perfection is not required to make something a user fee. With regard to factor four, we put on evidence of services Their own experts testified to the services. There did not have to be additional services. There were no additional services in Keller, in Arbor, in Missouri Growth, in Mullinex, but we put on evidence of additional services here. Not just Band-Aid maintenance, preventive maintenance. We had a list of capital improvements.
You have excellent briefs, and you made your points very well. Are there any more questions?
I have one quick question,
good.
Yes. Opposing counsel says their individual claim was timely filed. Do you agree with that?
They could have filed suit any time after December of 2007. They waited 6 months to do that. I don't regard that as a timely claim.
Is it 90 days from when they discovered it?
Well, it was within about 6 or 7 months of the time the ordinance was passed in December of 2007.
What is timely?
I don't know, Your Honor, but I would focus more on the fact that they didn't seek a preliminary injunction or a TRO. If they really wanted to put their money where their mouth is, they should have sought a preliminary injunction or a temporary restraining order.
Doesn't the bond requirement basically eliminate that possibility? I mean, if you're going to bring a class action, coming up with $90 million for $3 class members is never going to happen.
Well, Your Honor, we don't know what would have happened if the sole plaintiff, Mr. Zweig, had asked at the outset of this case for a preliminary injunction. He didn't do so. And the judge, I don't think he would have granted it. I think we had a good user fee here. But if he did, he might have set a very nominal bond. We just don't know at this point.
Does this any more questions?
No,
anyone else have more questions?
Is your view the Eastern District cases that were previously relied on for Hancock violations to have to file under protest, do you think they misinterpreted the constitutional provision?
No, I don't, Your Honor. We think, first of all, there's Judge Wolf's concurring opinion, and we think that is correct. And we also think that following the statutory procedures is required. And we think that the Fort Zumwalt case and the Taylor versus the state of Missouri got these issues right.
In the sense of timing, was the protest statute in place before or after the Hancock Amendment?
The protest statute was in place, I think, before the Hancock Amendment. Any other questions?
No, but any more questions? Does Wilson, do you have any questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you so much. Well argued, and I appreciate your appearing with us. And very well briefed. Very well briefed.